Master would just, you know, let it flow out in this tremendous flow of inspiration and tell you what it all meant, but he didn't necessarily tell you in the most efficient or the most cogent or the most orderly manner, and that was left for Swami to work out. But as he writes so carefully, he never added any thoughts. He just took Master's thoughts and clarified them for us. But he had to make sure he knew them, because sometimes the points were very obscure, so he had to be certain that he was not misunderstanding. You know, it's very easy to do. He had to be courageous and cautious simultaneously, so it was tricky. Sandy?
Actually, by 1994, when he did this, he no longer had access to Master's original writings. What exactly was he
doing? The entire Rubaiyat commentary was written and printed as Master wrote it in the SRF magazines during Master's lifetime. And everything that was printed during Master's lifetime in the magazines was verbatim what Master wrote. What was printed in the magazines as Master's only began to change after he died, which is true also of the Gita commentary, as far as we can tell. Okay? But the Gita, you see, went many years after 1975, so half the Gita is unreliable. But virtually all of the Rubaiyat, or all of the Rubaiyat. There's some little fraction, I can't remember, some little part, but nonetheless, it was virtually all written. And Swami had read it, and when he was reading the magazine articles, he felt very confident. When he reads the Gita commentaries that were published in the magazine after Master's passing, he doesn't feel confident at all, because it doesn't sound like what he read in too many ways, whereas the Rubaiyat did, so he felt very comfortable. Okay? All right. Now, what we're going to do is, Joe's going to sing for us, all from beginning to end, the 15 quatrains that we're going to work with tonight, and then we'll just begin to talk about them. Okay.
Wait for morning in the pool of night, has flung the stone and puts the stars to flight. And lo, the hunter of the east has caught the sultan's turret in a noose of night. Dreaming when dawn's left hand was in the sky, I heard a voice within the tavern cry, "Awake, my little ones, and fill the cup before life's liquor in its cup be dry." And as the cock crew, those who stood before the tavern shouted, "Open then the door. Know how little while we have to stay, and once departed, we return no more." Now the new year reviving old desires, the thoughtful soul to solitude retires, the white hand of Moses on the bough puts out, and Jesus from the ground suspires. Iram indeed is gone with all its robes, and Jamshid's seven-ringed cup where no one knows. But still the vine her ancient ruby yields, and still a garden by the water. David's lips are locked, but in divine high piping polity with wine, 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 red wine, the nightingale cries to the rose that yellow cheek of hers to incarnadine. Come, fill the cup, and in the fire of spring the winter garden of repentance fling. The bird of of time has but a little way to fly, and lo, the bird is on the wing. And look, a thousand blossoms with the day woke, and a thousand scattered into clay. And this first summer month that brings the rose shall take Jamshid and Kaigobar away. But come with old Khayyam and leave the lot of Kaigobar and Kaikro's Ru forgot. Let Rustum lay about him as he will, or hot in Thai cry supper, heed them not. With me along some strip of herbage strown, that just divides the desert from the stone, where name of slave and sultan scarce is known, and pity Sultan Mahmud on his throne. With a loaf of bread beneath the bough, a flask of wine, a book of verse, and thou beside me, singing in the wilderness, and wilderness is paradise enough. How sweet is mortal sovereignty, think some. Others, how blessed the paradise to come. Ah, take the cash in hand and wave the rest. Oh, the brave music of a distant drum. But to the rose that blows about us, low laughing, she says, into the world I blow. Once the silken tassel of my first hair and its treasure on the garden throw. The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone. And those who husbanded the golden grain, and those who flung it to the winds like rain, alike to know such arid earth are turned as buried once men want to dug up.
That's beautiful. Let's just have a moment of silence before we talk. Thank you, Joe. Darmini would play the flute, and she would play the flute while the was being read, but the flute was so piercing that we kept moving her back and back, and so she would stand in the bell tower with the door open and play her flute while someone would read from up here, and it would just be like this distant sound of the melody of the music for reading the Rubaiyat by. It was just so beautiful. Swamiji did, he wrote a whole piece of music called I, Omar, which is on this CD. And this is music to listen to while reading the Rubaiyat. It's actually, it's really beautiful. So if you want to, it'll help you to absorb the vibrations better. And I discovered we have one copy of this product, which is called Bird of Time, in which... he actually reads some of the quatrains to this music. He put it together in this one CD. Because the other, now that I'm just doing all this here, the other, which is this, which is the whole commentary read, he reads every word except the meanings, the definitions. He didn't read the definitions. He sings with the sound of tambour behind him. He reads the poetic translation to the sound of the tambour, and then there's no background, and then he reads the rest of the expanded meaning. There's nothing that has the 75 quatrains just sung straight through. Would be a nice home project if somebody wanted to just do that. Okay. Can I move back here? Am I going to be okay? Well, how close can I go to here? Okay. What I think I want to do, and it's sort of like I'm not really quite sure how to do this. I think we're going to do this a little bit like we did Whispers, which is it's a little between the poetry and the meaning of it. So I don't know, especially tonight, if we'll cover all 15 quatrains, but we'll just, because they're not dependent one upon another. What I found to be extremely helpful is what I'm going to sort of do with you, which is Swami made the choice in the SRF version of this, and the way Master originally published it, he put the definitions of the words immediately after the quatrain. But Swamiji's feeling was that it made you so left brain so fast that he put it farther on. And yet at the same time, I found it very helpful to really sort of analyze the quatrain for what it really means and translate it in my mind into very plain words, because even the paraphrase is still poetic. So as I went through and I absorbed more and more clearly really what the quatrain was speaking of, then I found it more and more enjoyable to read them. So I think we'll just start the first one, Awake for Morning in the Bowl of Night. Swamiji explains to us that morning, in this case, something else that makes these quatrains confusing is you get it all fixed in your mind, what the words mean, and then they mean something else the next time. Sometimes rose has divine meaning, sometimes it has a worldly meaning. You know, sometimes the words wine tends to always mean divine intoxicant, and the beloved is always the divine. But some of the other words shift around a lot. So asking for a kind of simple consistency is too much to ask in these. But in this case, he speaks of the morning as the time when we are living our lives in an ordinary way, and then somehow something comes and it makes us realize that it's not what we thought it was. And it's not necessarily true that you can put an exact time and place at the time when you first woke up, when the morning of divine realization began for you. Some of us can remember from childhood, sort of different moments in childhood when we began to think that things were different. I remember a friend of mine when she was 10. She said to herself, remember what it really feels like to be a child so that later when you get older you won't forget that it wasn't as much fun as everybody thinks it is. And you know, part of that, in her case, she's a devotee of Ananda, was really very much wanting to not get trapped by delusion again. She wasn't enough of a yogi to realize what she was really saying, but there was part of her that realized it had gotten sucked into the dream and it didn't want to get sucked in again, and she was really trying very hard to keep that thought in her mind. Sometimes, of course, for us, it was when you saw Autobiography of a Yogi, or I remember clearly the first time I saw Swami Kriyananda. I remember nothing of the talk he gave that night, nothing, not a single word. But I remember the sight of him walking down the aisle. That was 1969 in November. And his presence communicated to me this concept. He has what I want. And that was exactly even how I thought about it in my mind. I didn't know what it was, but I knew he had it and I wanted it. And there's just sort of that moment when you begin to awake. And Master once said to Brother Norman, who was a big man with a big body, Master turned to Norman one day and started very strongly saying, get out, Norman, get out, get out. And at first Norman didn't know what he was saying, and then he went on to say, just get out of that body, get out of delusion, get out of the thoughts that hold you. And so the Master often sort of works hard with us, even when we do the more advanced kriyas, which most of you have had. You know, it talks about how you make a certain movement with your body and you strike a psychophysical blow on the chakra with the movement of the body. I mean, how many of us have contemplated, you know, we're striking a blow on the chakra with the action that we're making by our concentration and our focus of energy. And it's sort of like it's just that force. Master encouraged the playing of the drum with kirtan, and Swami tells that story of how Dr. Lewis, being as Swami just puts it so simply, a Boston dentist without further explanation. Dr. Lewis was a Boston dentist, and he found the drumming, the Indian drumming, especially when Master did it, just overwhelming. And Master wanted Dr. Lewis to become more dynamic in his understanding, and he said, get into it, doctor. The drum beats loosen the karma in the spine. And it's just sort of hard to think, you know, the thump, thump, thump of the drumming loosening the karma in the spine. You can't quite get your mind around it. But what it is, they're trying to make us think in a very dynamic way. And so his first quatrain is awake. Awake, he says. And it's all capitals with an exclamation point. Awake! You know, that's what's trying to happen here. Come out of the delusion. For morning, the dawn of awakening has come. The bowl of night. Such a beautiful image, isn't it? The bowl of night. You sort of see yourself like trapped under this bowl of night, which is all dark. And we live within this shell. They made that ridiculous, and I thought very funny movie. Was it called Truman? Was that the name of it? The one where the man turned out to actually be in a movie? Yeah, The Truman Show. And there was like this edge to the world that he'd been living in, and it was all a fake, which is, of course, exactly what's true. But in this case, the bowl, it's a bowl because it appears to be seamless. There's this bowl of night that we live in, and everybody else lives here with us. And so we all think of it as normal, you know. But morning has come to that bowl of night, and this stone has happened, has flung the stone. This morning has come and we flung the stone, and Swami calls it so beautifully, delusion-shattering actions. You know, so you read this, and you read it with knowing that, awake from morning in the bowl of night. The dawn is coming to this dark place that we call home, and our own awakening has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. And the stars, of course, are just reflected light. So that stone of our own determination has driven those stars away. We're not going to be satisfied anymore with just this reflected light. And then he calls it falsely attractive material desires. You know, those things that seem to glisten with their own light, but in fact are just reflecting the light of the divine, that have no power of their own to satisfy us. You know, this is the everything in this world is a symbol. You can start anywhere. And if you contemplate it long enough, it'll begin to speak to you of higher truths. That's what's so, again, so exquisite about this poem. He just uses these images of life as we know it, but with his consciousness strings together these images and then says something so unexpected that it's taken another master to tell us what it is. And then we have the hunter of the east, the eastern wisdom, which is the, and you have again this image, the hunter has, I always see him every time I read this, the hunter of the east in my mental sky appears astride this powerful horse. And he's extremely upright and quite sort of, if not large, very, very strong. And he has sort of holding out some weapon, some undefined weapon that's very sharp and very shiny. And so the hunter of the east has arrived. And so I think of all my little delusions just quivering over in the corner because the hunter of the east has arrived. You know, these are all, you can go on and on with these words, but remember when we were doing the Whispers from Eternity, I was saying to you, if you just say, like Master, the way Master put it, is he said, if you concentrate long enough, the ink and the paper will reveal to you the consciousness that was put behind those words. And this isn't merely like an English class where we're trying to analyze what the poet meant. What we're really trying to do is we're trying to feel what Omar Khayyam saw when he wrote this. And he saw it. He saw it just like that. He saw the devotees, and either it was his own self he was speaking of, or he was speaking to his disciples, awake from the bowl of night, give up these dim, false stars, because the hunter of the east, the divine wisdom that is within you, has come. And then he says, and the hunter of the east has caught the sultan's turret. And the sultan's turret, of course, is the sultan is already big and worldly and powerful, and then even to do that even more, he makes his castle wall go up even higher, you know, so that all everybody little has to see. And so here, this one little wave has gotten himself a position on the ocean, and he's building it up out there, and he's trying to hold his position. But then this hunter comes, and the hunter of the east comes, and he takes a noose of divine understanding, and he wraps it around that turret, and he's just going to pull it down. And so all of this, all these wonderful images in these four lines of poetry with such mastery, awake for morning in the bowl of night, has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight, and lo, the hunter of the east has caught the sultan's turret in a noose of light. Isn't that marvelous? And so then Swami, of course, goes on, thus sang the inner silence, he says, forsake the sleep of ignorance and awake. For dawn of wisdom has flung into the dark bowl of your unknowing the stone of spiritual discipline. He does put that word in there, doesn't he, of spiritual discipline. What gives the stone its hardness? What gives the stone its hardness is our own willpower put behind it. And he doesn't just use an image in this case. He doesn't use a soft one. He uses a strong one. Because it's the stone of our willingness to undergo this great battle. The stone of spiritual discipline, that weapon of divine power that can break the bowl. In other words, we set our higher self against our lower self. And if we do that with power, then the change will come.